Amen. Happy New Year, everybody. My name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors at Revision. I'm excited to be here this morning. How about you? We'll try it again. It's a new year. I'm excited to be here this morning. How about you? All right, it's a great day to be here. If this is your first Sunday at Revision, you picked a good day to come because we are kicking off a brand new series called How to Start a Decade. This is the first Sunday of a brand new decade, which means there's all kinds of possibilities in front of us to chase the hopes and dreams that we had for things we want to stop doing or start doing, for who we want to become, for what we want to accomplish. But before we look ahead to all that, I want to look back real quick and ask you, can you remember where you were 10 years ago? Some of you can because you did the Instagram side-by-side image thing so that everyone could see how rough the 2010s were on you. That's me. I didn't have social media a decade ago, but if I did and you look back, you would find pictures in 2010 where I had hair and I had 1/4 less kids. It's crazy. But it's good, I think, sometimes to look back and admit that even though the last 10 years weren't perfect for any of us, though they were filled with challenges and frustration and pain at times, even though there's still a gap between what God says we were created for and the reality we're living out, we're here. By God's grace, we're here. There's air moving through our nostrils and a heart beating in our chests, and that means opportunity is out ahead of us. The opportunity to live the stories of meaning and love and impact that our souls are longing for. And what I want to do in this series over the course of the next few weeks is talk about how we can do that. I want to tell us how we can win the 2020s. All right, that's what I want for us. I want us to chase down this vision that we have as Revision Church to meet Jesus and follow him fully. I want us to grow. I want us to win the next decade. And here's why. Winning is better than not winning. That's profound but true, and I know it's true because I have been a not winner. I was a really competitive kid growing up, and then I got to high school and played a little bit of football, and we won 5 games in 4 years. 1 year we didn't win any games at all. In my junior year, there used to be this rule in the state of Iowa called the Mercy Rule. If one team got up by 50 points, the game was just over. Just quit. Go home. Things aren't going good. And that rarely ever happened, and if it did, it usually happened towards the end of the game, a couple minutes left in the fourth quarter, until we set the record. We were playing Davenport Assumption. It was like the Dowling of the Iowa East Coast, and we got 50-pointed on the first play of the second half. I'll never forget it. My buddy Joe played for Assumption. I grew up playing baseball with him, and I remember clearly standing there on the sideline, watching him burst through the line, 70 yards for a touchdown. Feeling conflicted, thinking, I should be happy for Joe. This is a good touchdown for him. And should I be sad that we're going to get 50-pointed right now? It's a little cold. Frankly, I want to go home. Things aren't going good. I'm going to be happy. Like, either way, happy or sad, I know I should be embarrassed. Right? You grow up and you see these movies where football players get to wear their jerseys to school. And I remember as a kid thinking, they're so cool. That is so cool. I can't wait to do that. Then you get mercy ruled on the first play of the second half. I'll tell you what, the next Friday, I wore my chess club sweatshirt over my jersey because I didn't want to get picked on. Like, winning, it's better than not winning. So I want to talk about how we can win in the decade ahead. And I want to do that by just introducing us to these 4 questions that I ask myself. I call them my dashboard. There's these 4 warning lights. 4 dashboard questions that I use to align my heart and aim my life in the direction God has for me. And right off the bat, I want to let you know there is nothing magical about these 4 questions. It's not like an exhaustive list, like there's no other questions you need to be asking yourself. Some of them you might think are dumb, or you want to change them, and that's fine. This is just a series born out of what God has been doing in me, and it's built on some things I wish I would have learned sooner. Because I'm convinced that if I had started asking myself these questions earlier, I would be more like the person I want to be than I am right now. I'd be more like Jesus than I am right now. And so I want to throw them out there to you guys, not to add to your to-do list or give you a bunch more boxes to check, just to give you a few of the tools in my toolbox that hopefully will be helpful. My prayer for this series is that it'll help us connect the dots between the dreams God has placed inside our souls and the journey it's going to take us to get there. So here's the first one. My first dashboard question is this: what is my posture? What's my posture? And this doesn't have anything to do with standing or sitting up straight, although I'm all for good posture. According to the internet, it's good for your health, so two thumbs up for that. But this question about posture has to do with the orientation of my heart toward every role and relationship that I have. It's about being honest with myself with regard to my motivation. Asking the question, am I approaching tasks and am I approaching relationships with a spirit of humility or with a spirit of pride? Am I about getting or giving? Serving or being served? Selfishness or selflessness? My ego or God's glory? And I ask this all the time in all kinds of situations, like in marriage. Is my goal to take as much love as I can possibly get from Jenny for my sake because I want it? Or is my goal to give love for her sake? As a dad, is my motivating factor like managing behavior so things can be the way I want them to be? Or is my motivation sacrificing for the sake of my kids so that they can become who God wants them to be? As a pastor, am I here to be served or to serve? Every time I walk up here, I ask the question, am I coming up here to stand not just on a stage but on a pedestal so I can be impressive or successful by some sort of worldly metrics so I can get puffed up and feel a little bit better about who I am and what I can do? Or am I up here to point to God, not me, to make me real small so I can make a real big deal of Jesus? Like, what's motivating me? Is it pride or humility? And I'll be straight with you guys. If you're willing to be gut level honest with yourself, this is often not an easy question to ask. Because sometimes there's a lot more me in my motivation than I want there to be. I think we all got a little Lady Gaga in us. We live for the applause, applause, applause. Live for the applause, applause. Live for the applause. We like humility. We respect humility. We admire humility, but we desire greatness. We have all these dreams about success and glory and honor, and we start dreaming that stuff when we're little kids. Over Christmas break, we spent some time with family, and I overheard one of my young nieces and nephews talking about what they're going to be when they got big. And it kind of flashed me back to some of the dreams my kids had about like what they wanted their futures to look like. I remember that when Jimmy was 5, he told me, "Dad, I want to grow up to be a doctor or a pastor." And right as I was about to swell up with pride, he threw in, "or a dancer." He's like, "What do you do with that?" Or a couple years ago, Emma told me, "Daddy, I want to grow up to be a judge." I was like, "That is such a cool dream for a little girl." And I was starting to tell her about, like, I wanted to be like, "Oh, you get to go to law school, and I actually know a girl judge at Revision. You can talk to her." And she's like, "Yeah, I just want to be a judge, like a football judge or a basketball judge. I like the stripy shirts." And in fairness to her, who doesn't look great in vertical stripes, right? But as my kids have grown, they've developed all these ideas about who they want to be and what they want to become and what they want to accomplish in the world. And I was thinking back over the ideas that I had as a kid, these dreams, and most of them were about greatness. I wanted to do something significant, something that mattered. Most of us grow up with big dreams. You know what? Most of us still have them. They might be different. They might have changed. The narrative might have shifted a little bit. You might not be walking the career path you imagined for yourself at 5 years old, but I know this. There are not many of us sitting in this room today who desire to live a life of meaninglessness and insignificance. We want love, and we want purpose, and we want meaning, and we want impact, and I am not here today to tell you to stop chasing those things. It's exactly the opposite. I think those things are things that God placed inside of our souls. It's part of what it means to be created in His image with the ability to create the future. Chasing meaning and impact is part of what makes us human. I'm just here to tell you today that the posture our world says you need to assume if you're going to go get those things is the wrong posture. It will not lead us where we want to go. So we don't got to look very long or very hard to get this message from our culture that if we want to be great and do important things, then we got to turn inward and look out for number one, that the road to success is paved with anyone who would stand in the way of our personal glory, that things and people and roles and jobs are all just tools to be used for our pride and our ego and our success. And some of us have been used and abused and run over by people who had a posture of arrogance, believing that was going to be their pathway to success. See, we got this issue in our society, and it's that we confuse wealth and fame and success with greatness, and they are not the same thing. There are a whole lot of people in our world who are known, but not worth knowing, because the truth is greatness is not found in self-centeredness or arrogance. It isn't actually found along any of the paths our world tends to walk in search of it. It is found in taking on the posture of the most significant, impactful life that ever walked this planet. It's a posture of humility. The Apostle Paul tells us what that looked like in the life of Jesus and gives us some clues as to how we can live that out too in his letter to the church at Philippi. So if you have a Bible or a Bible with you this morning, you can crack it open to the book of Philippians chapter 2. And if you don't have a Bible, don't worry, we're going to follow, or we're going to put the words up on the screen. You can follow along in the Revision app. If you don't own a Bible, we have them for adults and teens and kids back at the Next Steps table. They're free. We love it when they disappear. Take what you need before you leave today. But Philippians 2, verse 1, this is what Paul writes. He says, therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness or compassion. All right, quick time out. Paul's being super sarcastic here. He's looking at the church. He's being like, hey, guys, remember how the God of the universe stepped out of eternity into history and he gave his life for you so that you could be in his family? Remember that? Does that warm your heart at all? If you feel even, you know, slightly encouraged by Jesus dying on the cross for you, then listen up to this next part. He's being sarcastic. He's being facetious. He's got us right where he wants us. And then he writes this. Then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and one of mind. All right, so Paul says, if what Jesus did for you brings you joy at all, then what you need to do is step into community and love one another. You got to connect with the people around you and unite yourself to them despite all of your differences. And it's super cool that he writes this to the church at Philippi, because it was the most diverse church in the New Testament. It's actually the first church ever planted on European soil. And its original three members were a wealthy Asian female socialite, a rough-and-tumble blue-collar soldier from Rome, and an impoverished Greek slave girl. How in the world, in the first century, do you connect those three people in community and love? Well, Paul tells them. He says, listen, guys, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each to the interests of the others. This is an intense statement. Like, do nothing, like not one thing, no things out of selfish ambition, really? Paul says, yep, check your heart. Ask yourself the question. And every relationship that you have, and every role that you have, what is my posture? What am I aiming at here? Is it me or someone else? He says, do nothing out of selfish ambition. And what he means by selfish ambition here is that idea that I want to win. I want to be better than him and him and her and her. I want more than they have. I want better than they have. I want to be able to look at myself in comparison and feel like I am above them. He says, do nothing out of that. And vain conceit is similar. If selfish ambition means having to win, vain conceit means hating that other person when you lose. It's this inability to rejoice for something good that happened in somebody else's life because how dare they, and you wanted that, and it should have been you instead of them. Call it the Michael Scott mindset, okay? Paul's like, don't be Michael Scott. Don't be this guy who's willing to just run over anyone for your own glory and ruin anyone's day who's having a good day, because why should they have a good day if you're not having a good day? Don't live with that mindset that you deserve more than you're getting. and you deserve what everyone else has. Don't be a Michael Scott. Instead, in humility, value others above yourselves. And I read that, and I can't help but ask, like, which others? What others do you mean? Not can't be all others, just like the people that I like and the people in my family. What do you mean by others, Paul? Can you qualify that a little bit? He doesn't, on purpose, just throws out this really vague statement that in Greek is pretty terse. It says, do not look to yourselves, look to others. As though what he means is that if we're going to follow Jesus and be the people he created us to be, then the things that matter to all the people our lives are bumping into on a regular basis ought to matter to us. Like we're supposed to take a posture of self-sacrifice continually. But why? I don't know if you guys are anything like me, but I don't want to. Getting sounds better than giving. Being served sounds better than serving. This really isn't something that I want to do. So why in the world would I do it? And Paul tells us next, and what he writes is one of the most powerful and profound things in the entire Bible. Verse 5 says, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. He's God, but he still did nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking on the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. When Jesus had all the power in the world, he was due all the glory in the world. But he laid that aside so he could serve. He stepped into a place and a station that were beneath him, but he never played the God card. I mean, he could have been like, look, officer, I'm sorry I was going so fast on my donkey back there, but do you know who I am? God. It's just like, he could have done it. He didn't do it. I would have done it. I look at myself, I look at us and our motivations, and I feel like so often the posture that we have is to use whatever bit of power and whatever bit of advantage and whatever bit of ability we have to fuel our own ego, to build ourselves up, to tear others down, to get what we want at any cost to the people around us. And I look at Jesus and he did the exact opposite. He used his power to elevate others. He went straight to the bottom so that he could lift them up. And it's super cool that this word that Paul uses that we translate made himself nothing, we don't actually have an English cognate. It's not a word or a concept or a term that we have in our language, and so we got to paint this word picture for like made himself nothing. But in Greek, the word is kenosis. Can everybody say kenosis with me? Kenosis. Now you know Greek. Go you. Kenosis is this word that means self-emptying. Literally what this verse says is he emptied himself of self. He emptied himself of self. Self, that thing that causes conflict in marriage. That thing that causes problems at work and at school. That creates issues in our family and with our friends. Self. See, when Jesus stepped in, he emptied himself of self. Like out of the shape of the life he was living, he poured himself out into a different shaped container. When Jesus came to earth, he emptied himself of the God-shaped life that he was living, the God-shaped life that he was entitled to, into an us-shaped life for the sake of a broken world, for you and me. That's what he did. And here's the thing. God is inviting us to do that exact same thing. Like Jesus emptied himself into an us-shaped life because he was chasing this big eternity reshaping vision, and God is inviting us to take a posture of self-sacrifice where we allow him to empty us of us so that we can chase the bigger vision he has for our life, a vision of service and self-sacrifice and humility that'll lead us to a point of greater meaning and impact than we could possibly get to on our own. And the truth is we can only get there if we're empty, because if we're full of ourselves, there's no room for God to fill us up with his vision. And so Jesus emptied himself. He became nothing. He poured himself out into a human-shaped life to chase greatness, but it wasn't a greatness that anyone in the Roman Empire would have recognized. The glory that he got wasn't glory that anyone could have seen. In fact, it was the exact opposite. Paul writes this, and being found in appearance as man. Real quick pause. I think it'd be easy to gloss over that phrase, like being found in appearance as man. But it's such a powerful picture of the posture of Jesus. He so fully walked away from his right to the robes of royalty and clothed himself in humanity that people would look at him and say, that is just another dude. Like being found in appearance as man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Because in first century Rome, the idea of God dying was unthinkable. Even the idea of humility, of giving up your power for the sake of somebody else, was unheard of. What Jesus did was mind-bending. He allowed himself to be killed in the most humiliating possible way on a cross. Like, what an un-Godish thing to do. And I wonder sometimes, if even for those of us who've been following Jesus for a long time, if we don't kind of take on that Roman mindset and look at the death of Jesus as a really un-Godish thing to do. Like in our minds somehow we're convinced that Jesus Christ stepping in and becoming a human, being born as a baby in a barn that first Christmas, kind of stood in contrast to him being God and his divinity. We look at a baby in a manger and think that that is about as far from being God as you could possibly get. Like when Jesus came in, he did something new. Him and the Father were having this conversation, like, well, it's time to go in. Now I got to go do like a totally new thing. I'm going to become a human. And then he lived and served while God was in, while the Father was in heaven in glory being served. And we think that those two things are in this sharp contrast to one another. There's no way we can marry them together. Don't get me wrong about this. God becoming man was absolutely new in the history of the world, but everything else Jesus did was not new. Giving, serving, humility, sacrifice. That wasn't in contrast to who God is. That was a reflection and a picture for us of who God is and God has always been. God is a God of humility who has always stood at the ready to give himself for the sake of the world he created, even if it means death. Which really messes me up a little when I think about my own life. Because can I be real with you guys? Humbling yourself to death, I struggle to humble myself enough to lose an argument with my wife, even when I know I'm wrong. Like both times that's happened in the last 14 years, I did not want to lose the argument. And I struggle to humble myself enough to let my kids pick where we're going to lunch. Culver's. I don't even do good at humbling myself to do the Midwestern thing when you come to a four-way stop and then you all just stare at each other for a long time like, and someone goes 6 inches forward and say, ope, like, ope, ope, ope. I just go. And I read the Bible and Jesus is humbling himself like unto death. Like that's God's response to a traitor race that took his gift of freedom and abused it. That's what he's gonna do for you and me who tried to steal his glory and make it our own. It just floors me that Jesus was so intent on lifting us up that he let hands he created, fueled by breath he was sustaining, use metal he invented to nail him to a tree he dreamed up. And I wonder if that posture is what greatness is all about. Maybe that's the posture of greatness. And if it is, and if that reflects not just who God is, but who God has always been, then it has some pretty significant implications for us because we're created in the image of God. If God is humble, then that means somewhere deep down inside, humility is hardwired into us. It's part of what makes us human and helps us live more fully alive. I think for most of us, there's a part of us that can grasp that because we look back at times in our lives when we were serving and we just felt more alive than ever before. But there's another part of us that wonders, like, if humility really is hardwired into me, Why am I so terrible at it? Not me, you guys. That was a collective eye. I'm actually phenomenal at it. It's one of my many gifts, probably the best I know. But for you guys, like, why? Why is it so difficult? Because it is. It just, it runs in the opposite direction of so much of what our world tells us we need to do and be if we're going to be successful. I think for most of us, we're okay being humble and we're okay serving if there's like an expiration date on the humility. If we know eventually things are going to turn around and we're going to be served. Like, we're good with self-sacrifice if it's a J curve. Like, we can go down as long as we're pretty sure down is the pathway to eventually get back to the top. Like, for me, I know I'm good being in the back of the line for a while. As long as I know eventually Jesus is going to be like, okay, everybody, turn around, do a 180. Now Mike's in front. Remember I said last shall be first, and I'm going to be like, ha! You dummy should have read the Bible. I knew it was going to happen. I'm number one. Like, if it feeds my personal glory and my sense of ego, I am fine with humility. But there's this problem, and it's that Jesus is super confused. He doesn't think humility is the journey. He thinks it's the destination. And he thinks that serving others is greatness. Because in all of our roles and all of our relationships, we got to understand humility is the destination. And serving others is greatness. And that's a lesson we're going to have to learn repeatedly, over and over again. That's why it's on my dashboard, to ask myself every day of my life, because we live in a world that will pull us in the other direction. Our pride is always going to want to puff us up instead of bring us to the bottom to serve. But when we get this and when we live with the posture of Jesus, we really do start to make an impact. We become the change agents and the future creators God has us here to be. And again, I know that that doesn't makes sense on some level, because we live in a world that tells us to be change agents. To rewrite the future, we need power, because power is what brings change. But I don't think it is. I think power is impressive, but humility is transformational. So I believe if Jesus came as a conquering king in all kinds of glory into a castle, he would have amazed the world, but he still would have remained a God who's kind of out there and untouchable and inaccessible to us. But instead, what we celebrated a couple weeks ago was a God who stepped into our story as a baby in a barn wrapped in common rags and laid in a feed trough, who was accessible, and he absolutely changed the course of world history. Like, whether you believe in him or not, whether you've put your faith in Jesus, that he is who he says that he is, or you haven't, wherever you're at along your faith journey, he caused a seismic shift in the direction of the world because he humbled himself. He came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Power is impressive, but humility is greatness because it's transformational. So what's my posture? What's your posture? That's a dashboard question that can change the way we begin to walk into the decade ahead. Every one of you has influence somewhere, empower somewhere, whether it's at home, at work, at school, on your team, in your friend group, in your neighborhood. And all you're going to walk out of here and intersect with a whole bunch of different people throughout the week. And you're going to do that smack dab in the middle of a culture who tells you those people ought to be used for your purposes and your glory, to prop you up, to feed your pride, and to increase your self-worth. And it's not easy when we're surrounded by all of that to see honor hidden behind humility. And self-sacrifice is not a well-worn path. It's not one that many have walked, but it is paved with the footsteps of Jesus. And I just wonder what would happen. What would happen if everybody in this room decided this week, I'm going to ask that dashboard question, what is my posture? And we can't control anybody outside of this room, but what if just us, just this community, said this week, I'm going to walk out into the world, I'm going to run into all the people I run into, and I'm just going to ask myself, how can I serve for their sake? How can I make myself small so that I can lift them up? What would change about our world? I dare you to try it for a week. I dare you. That's my challenge this week. We just ask ourselves that question every single day. And then do the best that we can to head out into our week with a posture that looks like Jesus, a posture of humility. I understand that the world might look at you like you are nuts for living like that, for serving people and doing things that everyone would say are beneath you. But don't believe for a second that you can't do it. The word humility comes from the Latin root word humus. It means dirt or earth, the most common of all materials. See, the truth is you cannot be too common or too dirty to be used by God for great things. You can only be too proud. And if we are too proud, if we got to keep up our posture of arrogance and our posture of self-centeredness, if we cannot serve the way that Jesus served, what I think is that we're going to end up trapped in a prison of our own making. We're going to be cut off from the lives we want because we refuse to bow down. It's interesting, in South America, llamas are used as a cultural metaphor for pride. Because you don't actually have to build a fence or an enclosure to keep llamas in. You just have to put up a rope that's a little bit lower than their heads. Because they will not bend to go underneath it. Llamas stand tall and remain captive. And they can bend their necks. I'm pretty sure. I'm not a zoologist. You're going to have to ask somebody. But like, they eat grass. They can bend their necks. They just won't do it to get under a rope. And so they're the symbol of arrogance. Refusing to bend. Refusing to bow. Because of their pride. Locked in a prison of their own choosing, inches away from freedom. Listen, I think freedom, love, and impact are not that far from any one of us. If we just decide in the decade ahead, we are going to just don't live like a llama. You're probably going to want to tweet that. You can steal my hashtag. It's fine. It's free hashtag. Just don't live like a llama. Don't do it. It doesn't get us where we want to go. And for real, if we begin this decade by asking ourselves regularly, what is my posture? And we commit to following the example of Jesus and chasing his path toward greatness, then God will work in and through us to write a better story for our world in the 2020s. Will you guys pray with me? God, thank you. Thank you for the radical way in which you walked into our story in complete humility and gave up everything for us, even though we did nothing to deserve it and nothing to earn it. God, forgive us for our pride. Forgive us for the arrogance that cuts us off from other people and limits our ability to show your love to those around us. Would you just do a thing in our hearts? Would you give us a picture of who it is you created us to be, and so that in the decade ahead, we don't just chase power for the sake of being impressive, but we chase humility for the sake of being transformational. God, use us to point this world toward your love. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.